Matt.
Hello, David.
It's great to be with you here on our 50th anniversary.
Yes, it's lovely to be here too, celebrating 50 years. Which is what an anniversary means, 50 years.
That's right.
But we're actually celebrating a 50th episode-iversary.
Right, and in fact, we've only actually released 46 prior episodes.
Yeah, the first four episodes, we numbered them, but we never released them.
Right, it was, it's just kind of a way to pad our stats so we could get to this important 50th golden anniversary a little bit quicker.
That's right. And we've got cake. You got from Alonzo's patisserie?
Something like that.
Giovanni's?
Yeah, it's like a little old...
Alfonso?
Counter style. I mean, they had this lovely old sign. You know, the place has probably been there since, 1959. And the woman inside was perhaps born inside the pasticceria.
Yeah.
And we came in and were looking for cake. And
we got a vanilla slice and a small chocolate mud cake.
Yeah. The vanilla slice has, a little bit of a golden tinge. I was, thinking about something with kind of gold flakes. And traditionally, and on anniversaries, gifts are given, and the gifts tend to be like material resources, things that are increasingly precious over time. So, I'm not sure exactly what the early year anniversaries are composed of, but it's usually things like tin or aluminum,
brass,
string.
But then it gets
dirt.
Up to silver and gold and diamond and emerald and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think we've actually missed our emerald anniversary because we weren't taking it seriously enough, Matt. We're here to redouble our efforts.
I'm ready. I'm ready to start taking this seriously.
That's right. This is a very serious production.
We've got Shakespeare. We've got social theory. We've got...
bird shit. Double faults.
Labor theory. Theories on unpaid domestic and volunteer labor. It is a serious Australian Open 2023 episode.
Yes, and to make sure that our seriousness is really crystal clear through this gold tinted lens of an anniversary episode, we're going to start by talking about curses and how serious curses can be. So it might be seen as somewhat auspicious for us to be discussing something as serious as curses on our 50th anniversary episode. What does that portend for our own fate? Curses have come to the forefront of our consciousness this week as Netflix has decided to both film and damn several professional tour-level tennis players by capturing their likenesses on film. As it stands right now, no Netflix-featured tennis star has made it past the fourth round of the Australian Open. They have all fallen by the wayside.
That's right, David. The Netflix series Breakpoint has done these sort of biographical pieces on players like Berrettini and Tomljanovic and Ondra Burr and Nick Kyrgios. And every single one of them has either been injured before the tournament's even begun, or they've fallen short of expectations in one of the early rounds. And so people are calling it the Netflix curse.
I found myself wondering if we should perhaps, perform a curse. I feel like that's something that we could do. It's something exciting to think about. Who or what would we curse? And that sort of just led us into thinking about curses more generally. Like, what do curses sound like? What is the actual tangible physical impact of a curse? Is it something mystical or metaphysical? Like, what's going on there? Why did the Netflix curse manifest in this way? You have any theories on that, Matt?
Well, I'm all for theorizing on the spiritual and, You know, I like to think that perhaps invoking spirits, you know, can have influence on, there may be something beyond this physical world. But I do think on a purely psychological level, you know, it makes sense that if you think about something happening, you know, if you say something is going to happen, they talk about the commentator's curse. Like, you know, he's looking like a really, he's hitting his shots and he's doing amazing play at the moment. And then the next thing, the player loses or whatever. And
right. He hasn't double faulted in a set and a half.
Right. Classic.
And immediately.
He'll double fault. But, you know, I think you just have to look at sort of maybe Shakespeare as like one of the examples of, you know, curses. Like Shakespeare took curses very seriously and the supernatural very seriously. And in Macbeth, when Macbeth receives the news that he's going to be the king from the witches, you know, it sets this cascading chain of events into motion, because he's trying to make the prophecy come true, and that ends up cursing him. I think it's because he didn't stay in the present, you know, and allow things to happen, and instead he thought about what might be or what should be. And that's why I think the Netflix show is a bit of a curse, because it takes a player out of being present and instead brings them into maybe a vanity project, or wondering about how they're going to be perceived in this series, or, you know, because it's such a prominent TV show that these already famous tennis players are now thinking about how, you know, maybe being superstars.
Mm.
And if they win a Grand Slam, you know, and that gets that it becomes a good story on the Netflix show. You know,
yeah, it's like I think the Netflix show is also, you know, it's trying to, any kind of biographical piece on an athlete like this, I think one of the objectives that the filmmakers have is to expose the inner hopes and dreams, you know, to really like dig into the psyches of the players and like get them to reveal things about themselves that perhaps people wouldn't otherwise know. You know, we talked last time, I think, about how the Netflix series probably is going to just be inherently less interesting to people who are already fans of the sport, because we tend to think we know most of these stories. You know, like the amount that's being revealed about the characters and the psychologies is not, you know, it's not as significant for people who are as tuned in. And for us as observers, we also feel like, and core fans, like we feel like it's just not as interesting to look at the sport without that context. But we've already discovered it in many cases.
Yeah.
But to bring it back to the players, I think they are often, you know, like there's a certain life that they live as tour athletes, traveling around the world, spending all their time with their teams, their coaches, their partners in different cities, playing tournaments in a variety of conditions. The kind of rigors and demands of tour life are very pressing, and I think also if you're really committed to that life and you're a top player, you just necessarily have to stay in the moment. And we can observe this with the top players, where the, you know, their capacity to perform under incredible stress is perhaps what separates the great players from the merely good ones. And right, I think that it's a really interesting angle to think about, you know, players extending themselves outside of that normal box and how it might just subtly take their attention away from the thing that they're actually there to do.
Mm. I think a Grand Slam tournament already, you know, there's so many interview opportunities and sponsorship opportunities and commitments within that, having to attend interviews and attend promo shoots and all of that kind of stuff. So it is a heightened time. And I just think perhaps with the Netflix players, they've had to endure even more stress around this kind of stuff than usual. So that's perhaps why it is a curse. Like you saw in the episode with Tom Ganovich and Berrettini, the camera's actually right in the room, you know, right in the hotel room. They're going to bed, they're watching TV together, thinking about, like, you know, a camera crew being, and they're playing matches the next day.
Mm.
Thinking about a camera crew being in your room when you're trying to rest,
So do you think it is possible then to curse somebody without that kind of physical proximity or ability to actually like intrude into the lives, or at least somehow kind of touch on them? Like, you know, in Macbeth, correct me if I'm wrong, because I haven't read it in, you know, at least 50 years. In Macbeth, the witch is the witches who are cursing Macbeth, like,
yeah, I don't know if they
the around witches, the cauldron, or is,
yeah, he encounters them. He has an encounter with them.
Were they just prophesying? Or?
Yeah, they make three. They make this three prophecies. The first of which has already come true for Macbeth.
Somebody cursing us? it's some kind of disturbing sound. In our rush to curse others, we are opening ourselves up to some kind of karmic payback.
It could just be a few. It could be the rain.
Well, we just took a little break to enjoy one of our golden anniversary cakes.
Oh man, that vanilla slice is very good.
That was pretty delicious. We had a vanilla slice and a conversation about original sin.
Hmm.
But we'll save those details for another time. Okay, so what does a curse sound like?
It sounds like a crow. Caw. Like, it's nighttime and it's just, there's not much sound going on. And I think, like, yeah, like, it sounds like an animal making a sound, I think. Yeah, something organic, but a bit scary.
You don't think it sounds like the Netflix boot sound, or perhaps a USB stick being disconnected from a Windows PC?
Oh yeah, it could sound like that too.
I guess, you know, this is the Cyber Slam, we've decided. The Australian Open is the most digital of all the slams. So you know, I was wondering if maybe a curse was more like a hack in a cyber world.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the ghost in the machine, there can be some crossover there between the spiritual realm and the technological realm.
Mm.
And if that were to happen, it might play out with the line call system at the AO.
Mm. Yeah, I was thinking that you might have an interest in cursing some of the machines.
So that we can get real line judges back.
Right.
Yeah, because they do make some mistakes. They make some stupid mistakes. Like, it's already called a let, and then it called a fault. Well, that would make sense, actually.
Right. No, there was a let. I remember, I think we were at a match, and there was a let cord on a serve, and the ball was then returned, you know, not in play, but the returning player hits the ball.
Yeah.
And it just misses the line, the baseline, and then
back on the server side.
On the server side, and the robot says, out.
Yeah.
What's why that would about?
It
do
it? Why is it going to call something on the side that's just served?
Right. A human would never make that mistake.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure about that, but
it's possible.
It's possible.
But you can imagine, you know, if the line judge system got cursed, it would start like spewing out faults at inopportune moments, and maybe it could start faulting all the courts at the same time. Fault.
Yeah, we were discussing this, and there's an idea here that I really like, even though I am actually a proponent of line judges. I think they could probably take it a step further and introduce animatronic robots. You know, they could find decommissioned Disney animatronics like Abraham Lincoln, or, you know, somebody from the Pirates of the Caribbean, and like install them on the court to kind of create an illusion of life.
Right, because otherwise it's just this disembodied voice. Who's calling the fault? You don't see anybody. There's no one there.
Yeah, and there's something, one thing that I do think is missing from the new system is that when a ball is in, right, like, and you have a line judge, the line judge will put their hands, they keep their hands down to indicate that the ball is in, so a player can clearly see that the ball was hit correctly.
Yeah.
But nowadays, because of the fact that the only calls being made, there's no physical presence around the in-out calls. The only call being made is out.
Yeah.
Or fault.
Yeah.
So if a ball is out, robot, you know, robotically issues the out call. But if the crowd is buzzing and the players, like, in the moment, they don't always necessarily hear the call. And if a ball has been hit very close to the line, they're not sure if the ball was in or not either. So there's sometimes a little bit of confusion now that was not present before. And I do think there's something there that was lost that perhaps could be, you know, brought back with more physical robots. But to circle back on curses and hacks, I do think if you really wanted to make a statement, if you really wanted to curse the robotic line judges, clearly you could imagine a scenario where the Hawkeye Live makes some egregious error, you know, like a ball that was obviously in is called out, and it disrupts an important match, and they have to make some on-the-fly adjustment, decide not to use Hawkeye. How do they even deal with that? What's the backup plan? But it seems to me that if you wanted to effectively hack Hawkeye Live, if you wanted to curse the machine, you would want to do something that was more elaborately staged, that introduced more subtle errors over time.
Yes.
So that it wouldn't just be detected and then some programmer in a cave somewhere decides, like, well, I'm going to go fix the bug. Like, I know exactly where the issue is. You'd want something where, you know, just subtle errors, you know, sort of like the one we were just talking about, where an out call was made when it wasn't necessary.
A few of those, and then maybe you accidentally interrupt a point mid-flow with an erroneous call that doesn't have anything to do with the action on the court at the time, and they have to replay the point. But then it starts to cascade, and then there's more and more interruptions until you can't hear yourself think because the machine is just going off, and then they have to cancel the whole system and bring out whatever umpires are in the clubhouse have to come out and be line judges for the day.
Right. We like the idea of seeing Mo Liani out there, like, drafted into emergency line judge duty.
Right, because if that happened at the Australian Open, the only umpires available will be, like, veteran chair umpires. They're not going to be any junior line judges because they were never employed or thought about for this tournament.
Yeah, I wonder what would actually happen if Hawkeye Live went down. I've never seen that happen.
Well, the chair is trained to call, to look at all lines.
Right, so they can just make all the calls for all the lines.
From the chair, but it wouldn't be very...
I feel like there's been a thing also where the, you know, it's suggested that the athletes themselves will call in and out, and, you know, obviously that there's a certain amount of trust inherent in that.
Yeah.
I don't think an athlete, like, on a full run can necessarily see the ball very well. And they often really want to see what they want to see.
Well, what are some of the curses I would make? I'd like to see the umpire curse both players. and I'd see what would happen. And I think he or she or they could curse by saying a plague on both your houses, to quote Mercutio from Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, that would result in an interesting match. I don't know exactly how far the curse would go. We were wondering actually if we had cursed somebody. Like, I'm not clear on this. Like, we've certainly expressed some interest in Sasha Zverev having a bad go of things at the end of matches, right? And then he suffered this horrible injury, and you know, I felt even a little bad about it. I mean, he's a human being, even if I think he's
not a good one,
not the best one.
All right, presence in the sense of being there geographically present, spatially present in the place where the thing is happening, but also being present of the mind, in terms of your focus is on your senses and what's occurring right now, rather than your thoughts and feelings being drawn into the past or into the future. I think as a spectator, being at the tennis match, you know, is a great way to feel presence. because there is so much going on. There's an energy, a charge. There's all your yeah. senses are excited, so you do get to feel in the moment much more than you do watching on television.
Yeah, something you suggested this week that I found really compelling is the notion that spectators at a live match can really influence the play. And I don't know, perhaps that's something that people take for granted a little bit. You know, like a raucous home crowd will get behind their person and give them a little bit of a lift and perhaps irritate the opponent. You know, this sort of thing is more commonly recognized at something like Davis Cup, where there's expected to be a kind of, you know, parochial, nationalistic vibe. Mm. But I didn't really think about it in terms of like the individual presence, like just being there and saying something once, leading a chant, you know, crying out at the right moment. Mm. You know, we've certainly witnessed situations where fans obnoxiously will call out, like during play, you know, or cheer a double fault and, you know, like do something that like kind of gets under the skin of somebody. And it's a little bit, you know, at least according to the etiquette of tennis, a little bit uncalled for.
Yeah. And you see players react, you know, you see the umpire, especially this tournament, actually. Mohamed Layani was saying, please show respect to both players. Don't call out, don't cheer on a double fault.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's not a hard and fast rule. That's just, that's more of a etiquette thing.
Right.
But you do influence, I think, a player's mood, concentration, confidence by supporting them at the right moment or showing respect at the right moment, allowing them to concentrate more. I think Karen Khachanov was saying when he beat Tiafoe that he, you know, he really disliked, he's fine with the cheering, but the applauding his double faults, it's not showing him respect.
Yeah, there's something interesting here too. I mean, like, I think often this topic gets raised, you know, contrasting tennis with other professional sports and how pretty much every other professional sport doesn't have an etiquette about silence and, you know, like certain expected behaviors around like when you can move around or when you can speak or when it's okay to cheer. So it feels very like old-fashioned and alien to, you know, especially to a younger generation. And
yeah,
and you know, I certainly know when I take you know, when I take friends to see live tennis for the first time, things that I assume to just be obviously known or not necessarily, like the idea that you can only enter or exit a stadium during a changeover. And I also, one thing I observed on the grounds this year was the people, the I don't know what you call them, like the ushers. Ushers making more of a point to explain that, like, you can only go in at a changeover. You know, it's important to go straight to your seat. If you're not at your seat when they call time, just take the first available. Don't try to get there, even though it's going to take you another 45 seconds. And then Mo Layani is going to publicly shame you. I do feel like maybe there's been a little bit more of a conscious effort to reinforce some of the unwritten rules of behavior around a live tennis event.
Yeah, but and at the same time, I think it's push and pull because you have players like Kyrgios saying, now bring it on, just, right. You know, in the NBA, you know, you're trying to influence a player when they're shooting a free throw, for example.
Right.
And that would be considered mean-spirited to being calling out when a player's serving in tennis. Yeah, there's some of the commentators even saying, let's bring tennis out of the dark ages. Let's be able to cheer and jeer and shout out any moment in a tennis match and let the players have to deal with it. But I do think that that would lose something interesting that tennis has, like a history and an etiquette and a, you know, a social code that is about respect, and it's developed over time because people have found it necessary or interesting or, you know, good practice. It's kind of fun to, you know, to learn a social code and have to abide by it.
Yeah, for me, it's also a little, I think it's less about etiquette for the sake of etiquette and more about the aesthetic experience of taking in a live tennis match.
Okay.
Or just tennis in general and how it feels to observe tennis. Like, to me, it feels really starkly, noticeably different from other sports. And one of the major reasons for that is the attention, the quiet. Like, for me, the feeling of going into Noble Wombat Arena and having the place be so silent that you can hear the heavy breathing of one of the players in between, like after a point, we were watching Donna Vekic and Linda Fruvirtova play, and the crowd was wonderfully into it in that sense. You know, nobody was making a sound, and Vekic in particular would be pummeling the ball, and you'd hear her recovery. You'd hear air going into and out of her body, and like that kind of like closeness to me, that's there's a sort of intimacy that that you get in tennis, from live tennis in particular, and I just like that it is different from the other sports. I wouldn't want it to me it's less interesting when it becomes kind of raucous and fratty and, you know,
just a free-for-all.
Yeah, it just changes the experience of it. And, you know, you could accuse me of snobbery because I'm attached to this very, like, you know, like old fashioned, proper, like behavioral thing about tennis. But really it is about the, you know, for me, it's very joyful to take in a game that is so defined by quiet and attention and focus. Like, I love that about the sport, and I hope that it doesn't change. So I'm appreciative of the fact that they're trying to reinforce some of these things.
Of course, you're not going to go to jail if you call out in between a point or you cheer a double fault. But I think it's interesting that these social codes rely on people themselves, ordinary people, reinforcing them through our behavior. And in that sense, I think it really brings the spectator in as a full participant in the experience, because it's up to us to wait to cheer, you know, to cheer in the right spot. If we want to yell out to say something to a player, you know, and say, like, come on, Roberto, or come on, Tommy, you need to pick your moment. You need to pick it. It needs to be after a point, but it needs to be not too close to the time when they start their service motion. So you got to be focused on the game and choosing your moment when you're going to intervene as a spectator.
Yeah, I think it's also like perhaps just the nature of having a social code that is, you know, it's not strict, it's not hard and fast. It requires that the participants in the social environment are kind of holding one another to that standard and reinforcing it. I think, unfortunately, you end up in these situations where people don't know, like, what they're supposed to be doing. And, you know, perhaps they call out or perhaps they act in a way they shouldn't. And then they get, like, a, you know, these dirty looks and the shushes. And, you know, I mean, it does tend to, you know, there is a pushback against the kind of undesirable behavior from the tennis purists' perspective. But yeah, just it's something that I think if we care about the sport continuing to maintain that feeling, that it does need to be advocated for, you know. And people suggest that it become more of like basketball and just turn into a free-for-all, I think that would fundamentally change the sport.
Yeah, 100% agree. And to bring a bit of social theory into the mix here, Pierre Bourdieu, the French social theorist, talks about social fields and habitus. Like, habitus is something you feel in your body because of your socialization in the world, and so you are influenced to act a certain way, not through any hard and fast rules, but just because of the way sort of things are done. And I think, you know, tennis is a good example of a sort of a social field and a habitus that gets curated and reinforced, but also changes over time. But just not, it can't change with the stroke of a pen, because it's something that's embodied by all of us.
What if we refused to follow the rules of fashion? This question was semi-famously posed by Jeremy Enoch on the Sunny Day Real Estate track, Guitar and Video Games. Most of us tend to reject this proposition. Expressing ourselves within the range of acceptable dress and behavioral norms tends to be the well-traveled path. Professional touring tennis players are certainly no exception here. Visit the 2023 Australian Open and you will have witnessed scores of players wearing slight variations on the same exact Nike kit. A range of striated, amorphous shapes arranged in a pattern reminiscent of a topographical map or the cut interior of a large gemstone. Players in the Nike camp could choose outfits within a range, from subtle monotone expressions of this concept all the way up to the full bodysuit five-alarm fire that was Francis Tiafoe's outfit during his three matches prior to the defeat. What might be seen as stylistically bold or garish starts to become dull and repetitive as player after player after player trots out the same kit. All these players, following the rules of fashion dictated to them by their corporate masters. Yelena Ostapenko, on the other hand, has answered this question in the affirmative. Observing Ostapenko in action, one does not get the sense that rules or norms, dress, comportment, or playstyle are in any way something she concerns herself with. I recently had the strange privilege of attending the fourth round match between Ostapenko and young American superstar Coco Gauff. Coco is one of the United States' great hopes, a delightful player, and seemingly excellent human being. Someone who plays the right way, says the right things, and has been in a state of perpetual ascent since rocketing onto the scene at age 15, winning three matches in the Wimbledon main draw. Ostapenko, on the other hand, is actually more accomplished. She is a former French Open champion, but her career arc ever since has resembled something more like an electrocardiogram. Arriving in my third row seat in the corner of Noble Wombat Arena, shouting distance from Coco Gauff's team and family, I immediately noticed the brief cry of a baby. Who brings a fucking baby to a tennis match, I wondered, under my breath. Well, the answer wasn't far off. A stylish and clearly rich Asian woman sat across from me. Up one row, baby detected, bouncing in her arms. This baby was impressively tucking into a bag of honey soy chicken potato chips, an Australian delicacy, while Mama was downing glass after glass of white wine. Clearly, both mother and child would need to put something strong in their bellies for what was to come. Several games into the match, Ostapenko was receiving serve, positioned on the end of the court nearest to where I sat. As Coco started to go into her service motion, Ostapenko would start vigorously dancing in place, squeaking her tennis shoes blatantly, unnecessarily. This was quite obviously hindrance, a simple strategy designed to get under her opponent's skin. Good sportspersonship? Why bother? Says Ostapenko. Coco Gauff, to her credit, complained to the ump about what was obviously a distraction technique and unfair to her, but the ump blew her off. Obviously, a player must be free to move prior to receiving serve, right? Well, the distraction worked. Gauff never seemed particularly locked in on serve during this match. There were poor ball tosses and plenty of faults to go around. Her first serve percentage was a, by definition, middling 50% for the match, giving Yelena plenty of opportunities to punish the second serve of Coco Gauff. Punishing is actually quite a good word for Yelena Ostapenko's game, not to mention her overall demeanor and spirit. I sometimes call her playstyle casino tennis because she gambles like somebody trying to pay off her bookie. With every opportunity, she will look to crush a winner, whether it's wise or not. Playing within margin is not a concept found anywhere in her playbook, as if she would have a playbook. When she's on, she makes her opponents look helpless, even foolish. But when she's not, well, it's not a pretty scene. Fans of graceful, dynamic, all-court play are well advised to find another match. Ostapenko's court dress matches her give-no-fucks attitude. At last year's French, Yelena raised eyebrows well beyond their natural resting point with her frilly, unflattering pink dress with its seemingly haphazard bands and patterns of black and white. While less blatantly horrible, her AO outfit was similarly rough on the eyes. The red top, marked by comically oversized blue collars and a too-high waistband. The blue flounce of her skirt billowed audaciously, like a gown someone might have unwisely worn to prom in the 1950s. Her fashion, it seems to me, is more like anti-fashion. And she has the game to match. Unpleasant, uncompromising, punishing in both output and aesthetics. At some point in the second set, I noticed that I had not actually noticed the bouncing baby across from me too often. I was impressed. Look, if you're gonna bring a baby to a goddamn tennis match, it had better be a pretty chill baby, right? At one changeover, Mama stood her boy or girl up in front of her on the stairwell, able to stand but perhaps not yet walk. The baby teetered there, proceeding to grab the bag of chips, deftly extracting two fine morsels and inserting them into their mouth, looking around with the curiosity of a toddler. The mother, a cell phone camera ready in one hand, would snap her fingers at her child to try and get it to look at the camera. I thought to myself, Jesus Christ, this baby is gonna fall down. It's gonna crack its skull on the stairs. Somebody needs to do something. But all of that was just a projection of my own anxieties. The baby was just fine. Happy, satiated, and, well, mostly quiet. During one Ostapenko service game, suddenly the babe became restless. Yelena went to serve and the baby cried out in horror. I thought perhaps this is some kind of karmic justice for Ostapenko's unsporting squeaks on return. Or perhaps the baby too had the sense that it was watching something unusually unpleasant. I found myself wondering, is Yelena Ostapenko the punk rock of the WTA tour? Against the grain, repetitive, jarring, unpleasant tennis snobs like me. Perhaps I just don't understand it, like somebody who was raised on Elvis Presley and Chuck Berry records, encountering the Sex Pistols for the first time. Dismissing it as that this is just noise. It's not music. Ostapenko seems to play the same two chords over and over again. Her ball-striking exhortation sounds are something like a house cat ejecting a hairball. Just horrible to listen to, objectively. She wears outfits designed to elicit shock and awe from the normcore masses. And she also happens to be a natural Luddite, trashing the machinery of the automatic line calling systems in her post-match interview. She wants to get under your skin and basically just gives no fucks. Later, Matt arrived from Sydney to be present with me for an afternoon of live tennis. The baby, still around, still mostly well-behaved, stared the two of us down like we were aliens. Maybe it knew something we did not. When the baby grows up, we're just going to be irrelevant old men, yearning for the days of grace and beauty on the tennis court, while the future Ostapenkos of the world wreak havoc, breaking tennis down and rebuilding it in their image. Ostapenko won the match 7-5, 6-3.
The Sex Pistols are a good band, I see what you're saying, but I can't really agree that Ostapenko represents punk rock. But I do think that she mustn't really care about fashion or aesthetics because her outfit choices are not the greatest. Although I suppose there are a lot of bad outfits in the tennis world. She was wearing that houndstooth dress that was like had the black and white, like David Jones department store kind of vibe with the bow and then the pink version.
Right, but it was like patchwork as well. Like it was like cut into different segments and there were different stylistic elements in a pastiche cobbled together in this frilly, overwrought, kind of distractingly garish tennis outfit that she was wearing.
Right, and her new outfit for the Australian Open is, it's got that big collar and no sleeves and a very high sort of belt section that's like around this solar plexus region. It's not, I don't love it. I don't love Ostapenko as a player for the reasons you've kind of already mapped out. It also seems to be a bad sport.
Yeah, that's important to mention as well. In fact, one thing that was immediately observable to me at the match was that when she was receiving Coco Gauff's serve, she would start squeaking her shoes.
Right.
Like, it's one thing for a player to, you know, be standing to receive and to kind of like to start, you know, bouncing
moving
around a little bit, move a little bit, get ready, you know, like it's a way of, you know, priming yourself. You do a little split step, you can go either way when you're returning.
Yeah.
But she was clearly trying to obstruct and distract Coco Gauff.
She was making extra noise with her feet to disrupt the serve. Extra noise that didn't need to be made.
Right. It was quite obvious. Coco Gauff complained about it. The umpire basically brushed her off saying, look, she's allowed to move before she returns a serve, and Coco Gauff just had to get on with it. But it felt in that match that Coco Gauff was getting distracted, and so Ostapenko's tactics won. And if you're of the opinion that winning is everything, or the only thing, or the thing that matters most, then the ends justify the means. But, you know, this gets back into just the notion that there's, like, a correct way to play and behave, and Ostapenko is not it.
It's priorities, isn't it, as well? Because, like, maybe your coach says when you're a junior, you've got to win at all costs. That means never give an opponent a free point, never own up to, like, something. If the umpire gives you a point that you shouldn't have got, just get away with it. You need all the help you can get.
Yeah.
Rather than someone else who might go, look, I like playing tennis, I want to win, but the most important thing to me is integrity and sportspersonship and friendships. You know, you take it further. Maybe you have more interests in looking good on court. Maybe you want to wear clothes that you like, and maybe you care about the fashion side of things.
Mm.
And so you take an interest in that kind of stuff. Stuff that's superfluous to potentially to winning the match, but that maybe gives you an extra element of happiness in life.
Yeah, there have been times where I've noticed players like tugging at their clothing. You know, like they'll get a kit and sometimes it doesn't necessarily fit them well or suit their play, you know, like, and they haven't worked it out before they went on court, and so they end up struggling against their clothing during a match. And it's like, well, what's more important? Is the performance more important? Like your actual play performance, or is it just that you look a certain way, that you maintain your commitment to your sponsors? Because as much as we focus on the fashion side, it rarely is like an intentional choice from a player. It's often just, you know, who did they sign with? Who's providing them with free gear?
And what does the company they signed with want to promote this season?
Yeah.
So they got to play ball.
Yeah. Okay, so there was this news story that kind of came to the forefront this fortnight, because apparently the Australian Open has decided not to pay the ball kids who work for them, you know, so they're basically benefiting from unpaid labor being performed by children. It's You know, it's sort of hilarious when this sort of thing comes out. Other events do pay the ball kids. I mean, it may not be much more than a stipend, you know. Nobody's trying to pay them a living wage. They are kids. There are other benefits to them participating in these events and the access and the life experience and the, you know, the training that they go through and just being, you know, I'm almost certainly the kids are all like in tennis programs and around the game. So there are benefits that are not, you know, fiduciary, right? But this whole notion that, you know, the Australian Open is exploiting children really came to the forefront when Andy Murray played his 5-hour and 45-minute late night epic match against Tanasi Kokkinakis, which wrapped up at 4:30 in the morning. And it's not like they just break out the ball men after midnight. The kids are just out there.
Yeah.
Running shifts until all hours.
4 a.m.
Yeah, past 4 a.m. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, it's I don't think the Australian Open's paid ball kids since 2008 or maybe even 2003.
They used to.
They did used to. So, yeah, this volunteer labor that they're exploiting children for, I think it doesn't benefit anyone. It doesn't benefit anyone, any normal person. You know, like paying children a decent wage lifts up the wages of everyone, and it sets a good standard for these kids for the rest of their life. They expect, you know, if they do a job, you should expect to be paid. You can't be taken advantage of. The one who's benefiting is the Australian Open. And it makes me think of the way the state benefits from unpaid domestic labor, largely done by women and done in the household, childcare, domestic labor. This is all stuff that benefits the state because the workers reproduce themselves, and the state doesn't have to pay for the upkeep of, you know, our houses and the rearing of the children. But they benefit from the fact that there's a labor force that comes in, and every year, you know, more children are born. And it's not fair that we have to do this unpaid labor. It's not fair that kids have to do labor for free, even if they enjoy it. Like, there's nothing saying that you can't enjoy your work.
Yeah, well, right. The work isn't always glamorous either. I mean, there have been a few incidents this week with birds deciding to defecate on or around the baseline. And I don't remember this happening before, even though I do remember birds being quite present. Perhaps there's another kind of curse at play here, you know, kind of lighter curse. Somebody is...
I thought a great curse could be, may a gull soil your baseline, you know. Something you could say to your opponent, you know, and then...
Yeah, and actually it's not nearly nasty enough for me to not want to say that in the direction of a player, you know. Like, I mean, maybe not to their face, but, you know, if I'm watching a Holger Rune match, I might say, like, may a gull soil your baseline, Holger. Yeah, and you know, it's really, I mean, it's something that people can deal with, and it was interesting seeing the players deal with this situation and the unpaid labor, right? Like, players, I think, generally have the expectation that the people around them are going to deal with all the unpleasant stuff so they can really focus on the thing that really matters, which is hitting a ball with a stick. But, right, so two instances that come to mind. In one case, Andy Murray was dealing with some bird shit.
Yeah.
And he was just like, just give me the freaking towel and I'll do it myself. Because, like, there's all this confusion. You know, there's this hierarchy of people trying, you know, the chair is the person that you make the request to, and then he has to find the right ball kid to mop up the mess. And Andy's just like, I can do a little work.
Yeah.
And he just dealt with it himself.
Yeah.
Victoria Azarenka experienced a little bird shit on her baseline during her match with Zhu Lin from China, who had an incredible tournament. It was a really fun match that very few people got to see because it was late. But yeah, some shit happened, and a ball boy was directed to clean up the mess, and he like approaches with a towel and proceeds to push the towel against the poop and then rotate the towel and then push it again and then run away with the towel.
Yeah, he patted gently. And you could even see on the television that there was still marks left on the court. Azarenka's like, give me that towel. You've never done a day of cleaning in your life, clearly. And proceeded to scrub properly
right. The
bird poo.
And it was quite obvious that she did a very capable job cleaning up that mess.
Yeah. Maybe the ball kid was like, hey, they don't pay me enough to clean bird poo. In fact, they don't pay me at all, you know? Like,
right. And then there's this thing that the ball kids like invariably have to do, which often does result in these like kind of interesting, touching moments with players where like a player will find a bug on the court and they'll pick it up with their hands, and then a ball kid will receive the bug and then take it to safety.
Yes.
But during the Jannik Sinner Stefanos Tsitsipas match, Jannik Sinner just found like a big dead bug. And he was like, okay, well, I got to get rid of this. And he handed it to a ball kid who shepherded it away. I wonder what the training is like for...
We were speculating on this, David, and I think you came up with the... you imagined what the training for a ball kid might be. And you said they have to plunge their arm into a bucket of insects, live insects, and leave it there for 30 seconds without reacting. So that when the moment happens, you have to pick up a live bug on national television.
Right.
You won't freeze in the headlights.
That's right.
And you'll be able to deal with the pressure and deal with the sliminess of the bug or the, you also don't want to be like handling the bug badly and killing it on national television, do you?
Right, or like just acting in fear and like, I don't want, or like, this is icky, I don't want to touch it.
Yeah.
You figure that there is there must be a training for all of these circumstances that arise, because they all seem to be pretty capable of dealing with most of these circumstances. You know, it's much in the same way that a tennis player will get up before dawn to hit 500 return shots, off of a ball machine. I mean, the bucket of insects, I think, is probably part of the training regimen for ball kids.
I like it, but they need to be paid for that shit.
Yeah, full agreement there. So, aesthetics, the sound of effort, the exhortations made by players, I think it's an important part of the game. And 20-something years ago, there was a lot of chatter about, the sounds being made, particularly by some women, how intense and sharp they were. Brian Phillips once described Victoria Azarenka's ball-striking sound as that of a ghost going down a water slide. And it's interesting because Azarenka is having a great tournament right now. She's in the quarterfinals, and her sound has actually changed over the years, which was very immediately noticeable. Some number of years ago, she kind of dropped the water slide part, like the Doppler effect, the trailing off of the Vika scream, like got shortened and kind of, was made a little bit more traditional in a way.
They're more like just a ghost going down a very, like a slippery dip or like a short water slide.
Yeah, or like a ghost like vaulting, some kind of high bar or something. Or perhaps a ghost, attempting to frighten another ghost, which is, a little bit artificial in a way, because what does another ghost have to be afraid of?
Themselves.
So a ghost in a mirror. Perhaps it's a ghost witnessing their own incorporeal form in a mirror. That is Victoria Azarenka's current screen.
That's a very good description of her screen. It's totally unfair that women get targeted with the, like, they scream too much, because listen to Rafael Nadal's scream.
Yeah, we were walking in Melbourne and you started replicating a male effort, and I immediately knew that it was Rafa that you were performing for me.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's Rafa. We know it. Everybody who watches tennis, you know, in the volume that we watch tennis, would know that that's a Rafa effort.
Yeah.
Does that remind you of anything in particular?
It reminds me of sex. Of, like, pleasurable moments during, and, like, effort sounds during, perhaps thrusting during sex, or receiving pleasure during sex. Yeah, and even, like, when Rafa hits a winner, he adds a bit more, because he's, like, the effort sound, and then there's the relief, so... And that could be the climax of a sex act.
The sexual activity here is like, it's just happening at a very slow but intense pace.
Yeah, and if you imagine two grunters playing with each other, and I did some research, and apparently Andy Murray said in 2013 that Carlos Bloch has the worst male tennis screen. You know, if they were playing each other, you know, and then Burlock sounds like a bear being stabbed with a fork. Like, it wouldn't really make sense if they were just behind closed doors in the next hotel room. You'd be wondering, well, who's having sex with who? Are they... It would be like they were masturbating themselves at alternating moments, because the sounds of pleasure are happening spaced apart from each other. You know what I mean? Normally, yeah. when people are
right, the sounds are more concordant, and you know, I also do wonder if the sexual activity would be brought more to mind if there was more appropriate ambient sound accompanying the exhortation. So, you know, the shaking of a bed frame, the creak of the mattress, the, you know, the wall, the window rattling with the effort, you know, like the pacing the space here, you know, making it feel, well, I guess more appropriate for sporting match.
All the people watching in a big stadium, you don't often get that when you're having sex.
Not typically.
Yes.
I'm thinking about the effort sounds, and you know, you don't really get that same thing in other sports at the moment of activity, right? Like in tennis, there's this rhythmic action, the ball being struck, and that's when the sound comes. But like in basketball, if somebody has a vicious dunk, the sound is afterwards, and it's much more celebratory, and I don't think it's very sexualized, really. It's more like a, you know, like a war cry or something.
Right. Yeah, that's something tennis certainly has going for it. The ability for those sounds to sound like, or for us to imagine, sex.
It's interesting, you were mentioning that, you know, one thing that isn't typically true when people are having sex is that they're being observed by, you know, a stadium full of thousands of people.
Yeah.
But the silence of the crowd does contribute to that feeling, right? Typically, people tend to have sex in private rooms.
Right.
There's something about a tennis match that, you know, sometimes can feel like it can feel private in that way because of the relative quiet.
Yes, but it does build, like if the rally, or you know, to use our example, the sex act continues and starts building to a climax. Also, the spectators start to get more involved. We start to like vocalize a bit our surprise, and like, oh, what's gonna happen next? Oh, they hit a drop shot. Oh, is he gonna get it? And then our clapping at the end when they're finished.
Yeah, it's pretty much just like sex.
Sorry about that. Sorry, everyone. This is totally...
Yeah, very uncomfortable.
Very naughty of us.
Yeah.
The Tennis Tragic thanks you for listening. All correspondence and feedback can be directed to tennistragicpod@gmail.com. and our Instagram is @tennistragicpod.
Nayakal, soil your baseline.